This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Your source for Pan-African news and world developments, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Riot police in Zimbabwe violently dispersed demonstrators who marched to the country's central bank to protest the proposed introduction of bond notes to ease a persistent cash shortage. This is the latest in a string of anti-government protests as the country's economic crisis worsens.
That's Sebastian Amonfu reporting from Harare. Details next.
Also, South Sudan's new first vice president is in Nairobi to meet with Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. And 23 prison officers in Nigeria are fired for allegedly allowing inmates to escape.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, riot police in Zimbabwe have violently dispersed demonstrators who marched to the country's central bank to protest the proposed introduction of bond notes to ease a persistent cash shortage. This is the latest in a string of anti-government protests as the country's economic crisis worsens. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
Those are protesters, mainly young people, who marched Wednesday toward the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe. They sang, "We are tired." That was before anti-riot police started firing tear gas in an effort to disperse them. Those who tried to resist were assaulted and injured. One of those who survived the assaults, Tendai Mudewe, says she will continue taking part in protests.
Zimbabweans are tired. Zimbabweans are peace-loving people. But this regime, the government of Zimbabwe, has given Zimbabweans no other option of expressing themselves except protesting. Life is now very difficult in Zimbabwe, and Zimbabweans are finding their voice to say, no, enough is enough. The government does not care for the citizens, and the citizens have had enough, and the only thing that they can do is to protest. And I can assure you, I'm sure, the protests are going to be increasing as the year goes by.
Zimbabwe is in the midst of an unprecedented wave of opposition to President Robert Mugabe, who has held power since 1980, when the country gained its independence from Britain. The latest demonstration was organized by the This Flag Movement, ceremonially led by Pastor Ivan Mawarire, who fled to neighboring South Africa last month after he was acquitted of charges of trying to topple the Mugabe government. He has since settled in the United States. The protesters oppose the introduction of bond notes equivalent to the US dollar that are set to go into circulation in October. Some worry the bond notes are a backdoor attempt to reintroduce a Zimbabwean currency. Zimbabwe uses only foreign currency like dollars, euros, and the South African rand. Zimbabwe abandoned its own currency in 2009 amid unprecedented hyperinflation. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
In town to meet with Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta. South Sudan's new first vice president met with reporters in Nairobi today. He reiterated his government's commitment to peace and said his predecessor, Riek Machar, should denounce violence, form a political party, and await the 2018 elections. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
During his meeting with reporters, South Sudan's new first vice president, Taban Deng Gai, urged members of the press several times to be truthful in reporting on his country, saying they were spreading misinformation about fighting around Juba.
This is not true. The country is in peace. It is quiet in the whole region of Upper Nile. There's no fighting in the whole areas of Upper Nile, where I come from. The crisis that had happened in Wau are arrested, addressed. There's peace in Wau now. No fighting at all around Juba. If there are any skirmishes, it should be somewhere west of the country, in the borders of DRC, especially the areas of Western Equatoria region.
A tenuous ceasefire has been holding in Juba since the July violence, but there have been sporadic reports of continued fighting around the Equatoria region and former Western Bahr al-Ghazal state by Kiir and Machar's opposing forces. In line with the refrain that his country is peaceful and quiet, Deng announced that his government has prioritized combining the forces of President Salva Kiir and former First Vice President Riek Machar, with the goal of having one fully unified army by May 2017.
Parallel armies is what brought crisis last month. That led to the killing in Juba, and that led to the former First Vice President moving away from Juba.
And when that former First Vice President, Riek Machar, left Juba, Deng was installed in his place, a move that some opposition members rejected as illegal. Deng says his appointment is in line with the terms of the peace agreement. Deng suggested that Machar, wherever he is, should ask for peaceful passage to a location of his choice in either South Sudan or another African country, where he should organize his political party and wait for the 2018 elections. But Deng was unclear about what he would do if Machar turned up, looking for his old job back.
My comrades in the SPLM in opposition decided to put me in the position. I gladly accepted this. I'm also telling you, if my stepping down can bring peace to South Sudan, I'm ready when time comes. But what I'm doing now is that I'm not delaying implementation of peace, waiting for anybody.
Deng said he was not aware of recent allegations of violence targeting American aid workers, as well as the murder of a local journalist at a hotel compound in Juba in July.
I've not come across a report of alleging rape against foreign aid workers, but I know there's a lot of allegations of South Sudanese women and girls went through rapes. What we have done, the government have formed committees to do the investigation. And for your information also, the army have constituted a court-martial body because these are the claims against rapes and human rights violation are serious issues. And in WOW, a number of soldiers have already been punished. A capital punishment was applied. And unfortunately, this was not reflected in the press.
When asked why it took many hours for South Sudanese security forces to respond to calls for help from those inside the compound, according to witnesses, Deng said delays are inevitable, no matter where you are.
No, you know what is important, madam? You know, even in the United States, you come from the United States or from where? Okay. Even in your country, the police and army come late. It is not automatic. Huh?
Deng also urged regional bloc IGOT to have technical staff visit Juba and work with his government on the specifics of bringing in the recently approved 4,000-member regional protection force. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Jill. Well, experts are revisiting the impact of South Sudan's peace deal 1 year after it was signed by warring parties in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. A humanitarian crisis has largely crippled the country, including widespread food insecurity and worsening economic problems. Despite South Sudan's grim state of affairs, one expert at the International Crisis Group says the peace agreement can still be used to provide justice for victims of conflict and set the tone for economic recovery. Ayen Bior has more from Washington.
A year ago today, the parties of South Sudan's warring sides met in Addis to begin a year-long process of forming a transitional government of national unity, a hybrid court to administer justice to the victims of the conflict, and all other matters stipulated in the peace deal. But renewed fighting in Juba last month raised questions on whether or not the peace deal should be considered a binding agreement to guide the country. Casey Copeland, a Nairobi-based senior analyst at an NGO called the International Crisis Group, says the peace deal did not address some of the specific issues that led to the resumption of violence in the capital.
It's a very large document, 80 pages long, and it includes a lot of things that people consider to be causes of the conflict. It has a hybrid tribunal and a compensation court that will address some of the atrocities that led to the beginning of the war. It had various provisions for sort of improved fiscal management. management. He was going to promulgate a new constitution, look at issues of federalism, which many people wanted to see part of the sort of governance model in South Sudan.
The security arrangements that led to the arrival of former First Vice President Riek Machar and his forces in April are not stipulated in the peace agreement and was the source of disagreements between the two sides for weeks. But Copeland says those were separate negotiations. There was hope that Machar's reappointment would lead to a permanent ceasefire, but reports of violence persisted across the country, and political instability continues to threaten the viability of the peace deal. After fighting broke out in July and Machar went into hiding, he was replaced by his former peace deal negotiator, Taban Dengai. Senior members of the SPLM in opposition have since said that Deng's appointment by President Salva Kiir violates the August peace deal. Deng says he will work to unite opposition and government forces, a move that Copeland believes could be promising for the security of the country.
We have a peace agreement that's now looks like it will be partially implemented. But one of the things that the government has stated its intention to implement is integration of armed groups. Now, if these types of processes can begin, then they can reduce conflict in some of these areas, particularly some of the more remote areas where civilians are in much worse situation than they are in the capital.
Copeland says if South Sudan's economic crisis is not resolved, it could lead to greater levels of suffering on both government and opposition-controlled areas. She says one problem is that the widespread government corruption that created the economic crisis was never addressed in the peace deal.
What is the problem is that we saw a host of sort of mismanagement issues and corruption issues that could be sustained when oil prices were very high, when there was a lot of money to go around. But as money became much tighter, we started to see, in addition to expenditures on the war and costs for fighting a war, that the cost of corruption became untenable. So we saw the central bank running out of money. We saw the failure to sort of rein in some of these practices that were benefiting the few at the cost of the many. And this issue is not addressed in the peace agreement.
Nor is it addressed in the UN resolution on South Sudan, which Copeland says leaves it to the government of South Sudan to try to pull itself back from its economic precipice. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
Officials in northern Uganda say dozens of cholera cases have been reported at the reception center for South Sudanese refugees. Cholera is an infectious disease usually spread through contaminated water that causes severe diarrhea and dehydration. Left untreated, it can lead to death. Health officials are using cholera kits and increasing screenings to try to stop the spread of the disease. But between overcrowding and ongoing heavy rains, this could prove challenging. Elizabeth Polat has more from Kampala.
Over the weekend, officials confirmed that 45 cases of cholera were discovered in the Pagarinya Refugee Reception Center in northern Uganda. Although officials say most have been quarantined and treated, it comes at a time when resources are already strained and overcrowding in refugee settlements is a massive concern. Over 80,000 South Sudanese refugees have come to Uganda since fighting erupted in Juba last month. Pagarinya holds nearly 28,000 refugees, well above its capacity. Irene Nakasita with the Ugandan Red Cross says the outbreak did not take them by surprise.
We expected it. Actually, we have always expressed fear, especially when the weather changed. We already anticipated it and we put up measures in place. So as much as it has broken out, at least it's being managed. And if we weren't prepared, probably the numbers would have been higher and maybe the people would even have died already.
The Ugandan National Meteorological Authority has predicted above-average rainfall in northern areas of the country until end of August. This has stoked fears of waterborne illnesses continuing to spread. The Ugandan Red Cross says incoming arrivals are all being screened for cholera before being sent to Bidibidi, a new refugee settlement able to house around 100,000 new arrivals. In addition, increased testing of water sites, door-to-door cholera education campaigns, and monitoring of symptoms has been stepped up. However, budget shortfalls continue to be a problem. According to Relief Group, the Norwegian Refugee Council, aid groups have only received 20% of the funds needed to adequately care for new arrivals. Tuesday, the Ugandan Prime Minister's Office, the UN World Food Programme, and the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, announced that due to lack of funds, food rations would be cut. Charlie Yaxley is with the UNHCR.
We're now starting to see already the reality of that impact with the report yesterday from ourselves, OPM and WFP, that the refugees who came before July 15 will have their food rations revised by 50%. We hope it's a temporary measure and that the international community will speed up their contributions to the humanitarian response so that we can, you know, restore these food rations as soon as possible.
And there are indications that fighting in South Sudan will continue.
The refugees arriving from central Equatoria are telling us that there's intense fighting taking place in a number of towns across central Equatoria, and the armed militias have been distributing letters across towns and villages warning people to leave the area, and that heavy fighting is to be expected in the days and weeks ahead.
UNHCR is deploying more staff in the area in case the influx from South Sudan continues. However, without increased assistance, they say it will be difficult to provide even the bare essentials to incoming refugees. Elizabeth Pala for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Army Hayes, who heaped 21 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In Zimbabwe, demonstrators are violently dispersed by riot police while marching to the country's central bank. South Sudan's new first vice president is in Nairobi to meet with Kenya's president Uhuru Kenyatta. And dozens of cholera cases have been reported at the reception center for South Sudanese refugees in northern Uganda. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Militias supporting Libya's government of national accord continue to battle Islamic State militants for control of the coastal city of Sirte. The Associated Press reports a suicide car bomb attack yesterday left 5 people dead and injured more than 30 pro-government fighters. The attack occurred in what is believed to be Islamic State's last stronghold in Sirte. The militia offensive is being aided by U.S. airstrikes. The Washington Post reports that U.S. special forces are also involved. Among those following developments in Sirte is Jason Pacht, founder of Eye on ISIS in Libya. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy about the significance of U.S. support.
U.S. special ops have been on the ground probably for a year and a half to 2 years, and they were most likely instrumental in the Government of National Accord advance against Sirte. Before, they were doing maybe targeteering and collating human intelligence and reconnaissance. I can see that it's a new development that they're actually fighting with the Misratan forces. I imagine it's significant. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it because it risks a media and PR backlash inside Libya.
But how feasible is that goal of uprooting ISIS from Libya?
I don't think it's that feasible, because just kicking ISIS out of Sirte won't mean ISIS is defeated, because the attack on Sirte was like coming from the west, and it had been telegraphed for months and months before it happened. So the top commanders had plenty of time to flee either into the desert or escape to other countries. It's very significant and important to kick ISIS out of Sirte, because it means that they won't have territorial control, where if they get defeated in Iraq and Syria, they could escape to there. But we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves and think that ISIS is defeated in Libya just because some patch of land is liberated.
So where else does ISIS exist in Libya?
Well, we assume there are sleeper cells in Tripoli, probably in Misrata and Ajdabiya. And the interesting thing is that you have to look at ISIS not as a jihadist organization which is entirely cut off from all the other jihadi organizations, but as part of the larger jihadi milieu. And that's important, because these guys who call themselves ISIS one day had previously called themselves the Youth Council in Derna. And some of them might call themselves the Benghazi Revolutionary Shura Council. So if they stop calling themselves ISIS, they can work with Ansar al-Sharia, they can work with other jihadi organizations, and I think they're in most of Libya's main towns, and they're probably going to fight something more akin to a guerrilla war rather than, you know, functioning like a state as they had been until now.
Some experts fear that pushing ISIS from Sirte will not eliminate the terrorist group from infiltrate into neighboring countries. Do you share that concern, and where could ISIS fighters find a safe haven out of Libya?
That's exactly right, Mohammed. I do share that concern. The whole Middle East is obviously in a moment of instability, and there are many more non-governed spaces now than before the Arab Spring. So these fighters could find many areas that they would be welcome in. Consider the Sinai Peninsula. Consider some areas in the Tunisian desert where there are jihadist training camps. Then in the African countries, there's Mali, northern Mali, and some areas of Niger and northern Chad. So I think that there are plenty of places that they could go. I'm worried, of course, from internal Libyan angle, that they will just merge with other militia groups in Libya.
Final question. Would Boko Haram be a potential host for ISIS fighters?
That's a really interesting question. Boko Haram, of course, did declare its allegiance to ISIS, but Boko Haram then has fractured into different subgroups, those who are willing to attack mosques and those who are not. I guess the more radical Boko Haram splinter group would be a place that ISIS fighters from Libya would be welcome, but it's a far distance, but it's possible. More likely is going to Tunisia, Egypt, Algeria, and trying to destabilize the regimes there.
Jason Pacht is founder of Eye on ISIS in Libya. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi.
Nigeria has fired 23 prison officers and suspended 11 more for allegedly allowing inmates to escape. A National Prison Service spokesman says three of those dismissed were senior officers at the Kuje Medium Security Prison. The prison holds suspects recently arrested on corruption charges. Jailbreaks are common in Nigeria. The president recently appointed a new prison chief. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Jonah Cummings, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Shaka Sali has an exclusive interview with Linda Thomas-Greenfield, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, to discuss South Sudan, recent elections, and Boko Haram. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
VOA. Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.